thank you to the Beatles for that lovely prelude. Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Karen Deaton, and I'm a member here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, whatever your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or your inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or, as this morning, by our minister, Reverend Jane Espenson.
We're now going to have a reading.
These are words written by Bob Dylan's girlfriend from the 60s, Susie Rotello, from her memoir, A Freewheeling Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s. There are so many talents in those days who hung their work on gallery walls, who got on stage to sing, to perform, or to deliver stand-up commentary that was part and way ahead of the times. We were full of truths and enthusiasms, resentments, and of course, poetry, prose, and song. The words of President Kennedy's inaugural speech were the words we took to heart. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Today, what's in it for me is the question most often asked. The 60s were an era that spoke a language of inquiry and curiosity and rebelliousness against the stifling of repressive political and social culture of the decade that preceded it. History is accumulated one day at a time, and there were many of us who moved it along. I'm proud to have been in the mix. I'm glad I took the subway and got off at the right stop.
When President Kennedy was shot, I sat on the floor of our living room and cried along with the rest of my family. As we watched the repeated black and white scene of him waving and smiling in his limousine next to his pretty dark-haired wife, and then suddenly falling into her lap. It was 1963, and I was 6 years old. It was my first brush with death. My second brush was a few days later, when again, right before my eyes, Lee Harvey Oswald was killed and Jack Ruby was the named killer. I grew up with killing, death, war, assassinations, Cuba and Khrushchev, fallout shelters and air raid drills, and words from the prior war still hanging in the air. And Helen Keller and Anne Frank were also there, so courageous and bright, just children like I was. Would I ever do anything meaningful in my life to be remembered, I thought. Walt Disney presents every Sunday night with Tinkerbell, so sweetly touching her wand to the sky above the castle turret, and Flubber, or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, or Haley Mills trapped in some cave while the sea waters crashed and rose to threaten certain death. While on the opposite channel, the Lawrence Welk show and his bubbles were an option we never chose. We played kick the can with all the neighbor kids at night while our parents sat on front porches and played cards. And we ducked under our desks at school during the day for cover from the Russian communists who were part of the Cold War that was always looming at the edges of our world. Ragged and crying women and children walking the long and sandy roads in Vietnam while our tired and faded and dusty soldiers walked alongside them, helping them onto planes where they would be safe, or being carried themselves onto those planes by their comrades because they no longer had legs to walk with. We ate dinner and watched this plight every evening, and the Huntley-Brinkley report with Chet and David, told us about the world and Walter Cronkite ended every newscast with, "And that's the way it is." And that's the way it was. I grew up in a world that was built like a kaleidoscope. You look through a small, clear lens at the simple, pure world that was around you like a protective coating, a world that encompassed baseball games and paper routes and apple pie. Donna Reed and Dennis the Menace, Father Knows Best and My Three Sons. And through the other side of the kaleidoscope, the world you were shown was broken up into shards and angles of colors and shapes that were unrecognizable to your daily world. The Civil Rights Movement, and the death of Martin Luther King Jr., and so too of his dream. A few months later, the assassination of young Bobby Kennedy, who we all loved because he was JFK's brother. And although my brothers and I played cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians with all the guns and fake deaths those games required, real deaths were always around us, not the least of which the Vietnam War, with its body bags and flagged draped caskets and 21-gun salutes. The Pledge of Allegiance starting each day, often interrupted by the sound of sonic booms, and each day ending with Nancy Drew Mysteries or Daniel Boone or Gulliver's Travels. My childhood was built around fantasy and imagination mixed with real-life death and death and death. And then I turned 11, and we moved to Florida, where I had the opportunity to be one of a handful of white students in an all-black school. Having grown up with the Civil Rights Movement actually over by the time I was conscious of it, it was still a movement that I was supported by and that affected me greatly. My being Jewish in the small town of Duluth, I was acutely aware of prejudice and was committed, resolved to standing up for injustices and wrongs wherever they might occur. But that was being brave in the midst of relative ease. Now in Florida, I had the chance to not only support the rights of blacks, but to see what it was like to be a minority. For if I was ever going to be part of the cause, and causes were the backdrop of my existence, then I felt I could only do that authentically by being right in the midst of the truth. I read Cry the Beloved Country about the apartheid in South Africa. I read every book I could find about the Underground Railroad system during the Civil War, knowing full well that I would have been an abolitionist if I had lived during that time. And I read Black Like Me, a true story of a white journalist who stains his skin black in order to be able to pass as black while traveling through the Deep South and write about the difficulties the blacks faced in at least those parts of the United States. I wanted to be a journalist and write about things that mattered. When I was 12, I followed the political life of a black woman named Shirley Chisholm, who later ran for president. I went to a rally for her once, here in Madison, where we ate soul food, and I got to sit next to her and talk about the future. And she told me to become a politician, or at least an ambassador, or go into the Peace Corps and work with the needs of those who lived in the most troubled countries, and I vowed that I would do that. And still, the Vietnam War raged on, and I turned 13, and my skirts got shorter, and my hair grew down my back, and the smell of pot and the sound of the sitar filled the air. The first step for mankind took place on the moon while we were watching Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and the Smothers Brothers were acting goofy, and bell-bottoms and Nehru collars, long skirts and long hair, and peace signs and protests and sit-ins and Woodstock and young people, young people, young people everywhere. The men on the news were old. Our teachers were old. Our parents were old. Everyone was old but us. And I wasn't even really one of the us, because I was still so young. But I was really influenced by the usness of those youth, by their anti-disestablishmentarianism, by the counterculture, by the Beatles' White Album, and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which we all knew stood for LSD. and tripping and psychedelic music and just being free to be you and me. And still the war raged on, and the youth continued to be the voice of the nation, the power, the strength, the no-nonsense attitude of calling an end to the needless war and to call out the hypocrisy of the people, their parents' ages, who had said no more after World War II, who had said never again. And then Vietnam came, and again was the name of the game. For a war, no one knew why we were there. And our brothers and our cousins and our sons and our all too young boys in the neighborhood were being drafted, sent to die for a cause no one wanted to be a part of. And the nation didn't end the war, but turned its back on the soldiers that very war destroyed. And those young men came back to abuse and to shunning and to a land that turned them out into the streets. When I was 14, I got a POW MIA bracelet with the name of First Lieutenant Eric J. Huberth and the date of 5/13/1970 engraved upon it. I wore that bracelet until I was 48 years old. When one day I did an internet search on Eric J. Huberth and found out that he'd been promoted to captain sometime in the intervening years, but that he was still missing in action. And 5/13/70, he was 25 years old. The day I found that news, the bracelet on my wrist split in two. I still have it in a drawer in my house. Make love, not war, was the slogan of the 60s. Peace signs and flower power signs and Women's Lib and Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul and Mary and Joan Baez and the Mamas and the Papas and those young people around me, those university students who seemed so old to me, were solid and grounded and sure and feisty. They didn't just sing, they sang out. They didn't just complain, they demonstrated. They didn't just wring their hands and wonder what was happening to our country. They protested and they fought and they took to the streets and they took over Greenwich Village and they created a segment of the culture that wasn't just their own. It was ours. It wasn't a subculture, as they called it, but it was the real world that I grew up in and was so greatly influenced by. Those young people of that day were at least 10 years older than I was. They were the movers and shakers of that era. They told me, they told us all, how to think and how to behave, what to believe in and what to react against. They showed us a world where the women were strong and the men were good looking and the children were above average. And I was one of those children, and I would one day be one of those strong women. Those young people of the 60s, by example, left a huge footprint for me to try to fit myself into. And try I did, for I believed in everything the world those young people had to show me that they had created for me. And so here we are today. A nation as rife with angst and betrayal as ever the days of the 60s were. That brave new world those young people fought for was the world I was sure I would inherit, and my children and my children's children for seven generations hence. For so surely were those seeds sown, and so surely were those crops tended and harvested. So what happened? How did we get here from there? Where did we take a wrong turn? Where did it all begin? This downward slippery slope of cutting back and cutting off and cutting out the security nets for the people of this great nation. Why did we turn a blind eye or turn a deaf ear or stand mute and become muddled and befuddled and in the end become downtrodden and hopeless so that the way was paved clear for atrocities to occur? Who are we to blame? Where can we turn to for help? Only to ourselves. And that is a great place to start. As hopeless as these times seem, we have the past to draw from, coupled with the wisdom of the current youth. We have those young people of the 60s right here in our midst today. Gray-haired, perhaps, but that is of no consequence. Their hearts are the same, their feistiness is no less. Their souls are not weakened, but wiser. Their resolve renewed by their hope for the youth of today, for the life they wish for today and for all the days to come. For the times they are a-changing, and it has once more begun. Thank you. I have some closing words, and then we have a closing song. These closing words are entitled Fearful Joy. It is beyond thee to be glad. Is it beyond thee to be glad with the gladness of this rhythm, to be tossed and lost and broken in the world of this fearful joy? All things rush on, they stop not, they look not behind, no power can hold them back, they rush on. Keeping step with that restless, rapid music, seasons come dancing and pass away. Colors, tunes, and perfumes pour in endless cascades in the abounding joy that scatters and gives up and dies every moment. We are now in the midst of fearfulness. Let us turn it into fearful joy.